Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Irish Country Living Podcast.
Hi folks, you're very welcome back to the Irish Country Living Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Donahue. This week's guest on the podcast is Professor Mike Gibney. Professor Gibney is an emeritus professor at University College Dublin of Food and Health Science. I said that correctly, I think. Emeritus. I'm having a little bit of trouble with that word. Professor Gibney is also an author. He just recently released his new book, Food Through the Ages. So we discussed a little bit, firstly about his academic career, then obviously about his new book. It deals with history of food, and then we have a very interesting chat about the future of food. Professor Gibney says in his book that future diets will be more plant-based. So we dissect this as to why he made the statement and I suppose the reasoning around it. And interestingly, this statement is less alarming for farmers than initially it may seem. But firstly, I start off by asking, what is an emeritus professor? And as you can hear, I have pronounced it wrong. What is an emeritus professor? And am I even saying that correctly now?
Well, it's usually pronounced emeritus, but basically, when you retire as a professor, you can be awarded the emeritus title, which means that I can still use the email, I can still use the library, and all of the facilities you need for research. Obviously, I don't go in, I don't have a laboratory anymore or an office, but the things that are important, which is the email and the library, you get that.
So you're kind of a VIP?
Sort of, I suppose you could say that now.
Yeah. So you're a student for life?
Student for life, yeah, never stops.
Yeah, we all are. And I suppose now that we have that down, Professor Gibney, tell me a small bit about your background. I gather one of your first forays in education was ag chemistry, am I right?
That's right. I did ag science, specialising in chemistry in the Albert College. And I did a master's in the nutrition of lambs. Then I went to Sydney University and did my doctorate there in the veterinary school, again working on lambs. And then I moved from animal nutrition to human nutrition. I moved to the University of Southampton Medical School and spent about 8 years there. Then I moved to the Department of Medicine in Trinity in St. James's Hospital for 25 years. And then I moved back to UCD for the last 6 years. So there you go.
Very, very, very distinguished. And I suppose just going back to the ag side of things at the start, what did anything in particular draw you towards the ag science side of things?
Well, I had a big interest in food. When I was growing up, you see, the Irish industry was dominated by the food industry. So Kerrygold was only being developed as a brand. You had Tony O'Reilly running Aran Foods. You had Mickey Joe Costello running Irish Sugar. You had Father McDyer running cooperatives, food cooperatives up in Donegal. And I wanted to study food science, but there was no food science degree. There was dairy science down in Cork, and there was nothing in Dublin. So I went to see the dean of the Faculty of Agriculture, and he suggested I talk to the people in agricultural chemistry. And I did. And it was basically animal nutrition, but animal nutrition is very similar to human nutrition. So the transition was very easy.
But you always kind of knew it was more towards food and nutrition that it was where you wanted to go.
Exactly. I've been lucky that I've stayed where I wanted to be.
And did anything in particular in your life, Professor, pique that interest in food and nutrition for you?
No, you see, I grew up after De Valera went into retirement and we had Sean Lamass as the vibrant new Taoiseach. There was a great buzz around Ireland and the food industry was the dot-com of its day. And so that's what sort of attracted me to it. And I made my career there and stayed there.
So it was cutting edge at the time?
Oh, it was, yes. It was the most important industry in the country.
Yeah, very, very, very interesting. And it arguably possibly still is, depends on who you ask.
What's that?
I said arguably possibly still is. It depends on who you ask.
It depends on who you ask, yes. Yes. There was another very inspiring person, though. There was the late Justin Keating, who was a professor of veterinary pathology. He ran a program that some of your older readers might remember called Landmark. And he had a marvelous ability to communicate about agriculture, the science of it, the science of animals, health, disease, reproduction, the same with crops. And it was fascinating. So I was, you know, hooked onto the science quite early.
And your new book is looking back at the history of food, you know, food yeah. through the ages. It's out on shelves now, is it, Professor?
It is, and it's available from the publisher Liffey Press.
And what drew you towards the history of food? I suppose had you come full circle and that you'd analysed all the science of it, you decided to look back into the history of it.
No, I've always enjoyed reading books which involve the history of food, but many of them are written by historians. And they're not really the sort of thing that the average person would read. A big foodie like me would do it, but the average person wouldn't. And I am firmly of the view that the more you know about the food you eat, the more you know about its history, the more you can appreciate it. And an appreciation of food is, if you like, the start to maybe pursuing a healthy diet and for us to pursue a sustainable agriculture. So I just believe that the more you know about what's on your plate, the more you'll appreciate it. And that was my motivation.
So the history of food can, I suppose, inform even our thoughts around food now, potentially?
Yes, I mean, in a way it can. It's mostly just of interest so that people will understand, you know, where coffee and tea and rice and potatoes and noodles and pasta came from, etc. But also, I mean, at the very end of the book, I do talk about the future, and the future is going to be more plant-based diets. And you can have two ways of getting into a plant-based diet. One is you can buy lots of beans and go home and cook curries, or you can go and buy processed vegetarian foods. You can buy almond milk and soya milk. Not the sort of thing the Farmers Journal wants to hear about. The future will change a little bit of the foods we eat, but I believe that all of the foods that I've mentioned in the book will be eaten 1,000 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you believe they're all kind of still in the future. Yeah. And talk to me about a few of the foods that you focused in on. Potatoes. Why do Irish people have such an affinity with potatoes?
Well, when the potatoes arrived in Europe, they weren't particularly popular with people. That's the first thing. There were three reasons. One, if you don't manage potatoes, they go green. And the greenness has under the skin a thing called an alkaloid. And it causes effects on the nervous system. And it looked like leprosy. So they were afraid of that. The second reason is that the potato bush looks like deadly nightshade, which was used as a poison by the Romans. And the third one was that at the time, the dietetic theory was the higher in the sky food came from, the nearer it was to God. And the further away it was from the sky, so root crops, were the least desirable food. So potatoes didn't really take off. But when they did, they were particularly important in Ireland. About a third of the arable land in Ireland was devoted to potatoes, and only about 7% in the rest of Europe. And we were eating about 3 to 4 times the amount of potatoes that people in Europe would. And potatoes will grow anywhere. And they're a crop that you can put in between other crops. So because it was easy to grow, and because you could get, if you had leftovers, you'd feed it to pigs. And, you know, if the potatoes went bad, the pigs would love it, you know. So I think it was that, really. It was a crop that produces more calories per hectare than any other cereal crop. So I'd say that's the reason.
And partly in that part about potatoes that you talk about, you discussed that it gave the labouring class great strength. And, you know, it was very nutritional towards them. They were well built and it was, you know.
Yeah, there was the East India Trading Company was a big exploration company in England, and they had an army and a navy, and they had recruits from Ireland. And on average, the records show the Irish recruits were 1 inch taller than their age-matched English counterparts. So, and between 1700 and 1900, around about 25% of the growth of the population in Europe was due to the arrival of the potato. So it really did have a serious impact on, it coincided with the Industrial Revolution, and it was the right crop at the right time.
And has dairy always been a big part of our diet here in Ireland?
Sorry?
Has dairy always been a big part of our diet here in Ireland?
Well, dairy has always been a big part in every, almost every country. I mean, it's dairy foods are highly dense in micronutrients. So the advent of herding cattle or goats would have meant that early people got high protein, high minerals and vitamins, and they recognized the value of that, the healthiness of that. And so milk isn't a very stable food. So we got butter, we got cream, we got cheese, and we got yogurt out of it. And in different parts of the world, yogurt is more important than cheese, and in other parts. But we have had a high intake of milk traditionally, partly because we have dairy farmers as well. A big output of our economy is still related to dairy farming.
Yes, yes. So I suppose, you know, it depends on what you have is what you eat, I suppose.
Yeah.
And so, you were touching there, Professor, on the future of food. And you said there that you feel like the future of food is plant-based. Why would you not see meat as a part of a diet?
I didn't say it would be. There will be more plant-based, because people will be of the view that plant-based foods are less demanding on the climate resources than animal-based foods. And there's truth in that. So there will be a move, and all of the big companies like the Nestle's and the Unilever's and what have you, they're moving towards making foods, simulating chickens, dishes with plant foods. And if you remember Linda McCartney's sausages and all of those, they've been around for a long time using a fungus protein. So I do think there would be a growth in that. There's a big growth in vegetarianism. And definitely there will be a move towards more plants, but I believe it will be plant foods which are processed, more so than people going home and cooking their bean curries and making their meatloaf or meat or whatever pies they do.
And you were speaking there, I suppose, about the kind of synthesized protein, or, you know, the Linda McCartney sausages. Is that something, though, that is it healthy to be putting that, you know, unnatural protein into your body, or grown protein?
Well, I mean, it's not unnatural, because the fungus, a mushroom is a fungus, and many of our cheeses have fungi in them. So fungi are perfectly normal part of our diets. And all they're doing is using the fact that a fungus has a long, 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 long filament. So you can twist it this way or that way. And penne is a natural. It's made, you know, it's processed into what it is from flour. So you could say the same of bread. It's processed into its shape and different shapes from ordinary white flour, and no different in terms of processing than, say, Linda McCartney sausages.
And do you think, I suppose, in terms of meat and dairy, do you think it's part of maybe a fad movement, that it's kind of cool now not to eat meat or to reduce your dairy consumption? Because I would even know anecdotally a lot from my friends that, you know, it seems to be the easy thing to do in terms of, I suppose, saying that you're being, you know, environmentally sustainable. I still want to go on 3 holidays a year, but, you know, I'll reduce my meat consumption. That will make me feel better about what I'm doing for the environment.
Yeah, I'd be inclined to agree with that it is a fashion, but it's one that's also driven by policymakers and governmental and UN publications will be pushing for less and less livestock the use of livestock in meat production, particularly ruminant livestock. And so that policy push will feed into the media. The media will feed into social media, and it will become word of mouth and gossip and trendy and fashionable. But behind it, there will be a big push from, if you like, big policymakers
to reduce meat and dairy consumption.
Yeah. To move away from high intakes of meat and consumption. I mean, I would be completely opposed to the idea of, eliminating. I would completely opposed to that. And milk is so important a source of micronutrients. And plant-based milks are on the record in published papers as not all being, the full shilling when it comes to micronutrients. And there's no comparison between them in terms of micronutrients. So I cannot see anywhere where we would reduce, reduce milk production or milk consumption. I think that would be a mistake. And in the most vegetarian country in the world, which would be India, milk is still an important food, and they use it in their desserts in a big way, and it's a very popular food. Meat isn't, but milk is. And again, it's because people realized for a long, long time that the high level of micronutrients and high quality of protein in milk and its availability makes it a fantastic food.
Okay. And where would you see meat protein fitting into diets in the future?
Well, in the same way that it is at the moment, except that maybe people would moderate the amount of meat they come. I mean, if somebody's eating it 7 days a week, every day having meat on the plate, the trend will be towards, well, maybe have fish twice a week and maybe have just neither fish nor meat one day of the week. So you're not talking about getting rid of it. You're talking about reducing it. Like, for example, in the US, the consumption, per capita consumption of meat is enormous. And they should bring it down. But in Italy, it's not enormous. And there's no reason why they should moderate their intake. So countries like Australia, Canada, probably UK and Ireland, US, maybe we should look at it. And certainly South America would as well.
And Professor, is this from a nutritional point of view or an environmental point of view?
Environmental mainly.
Environmental, not nutritional.
No.
Nutritionally, is meat still a very good source of protein for humans?
Yes, it's a very good source of protein and a very good source of iron and zinc. Yes, still a very good source.
Okay, so I suppose nutritionally, meat is fairly sound. The only reason, I suppose, for reducing would be environmental reasons.
Environmental means, and as you say, fashion.
Fashion, yeah, perfect. So I suppose it's very interesting to look at diets in the future, because I suppose, it's interesting to see where you think they'll go and where they may go.
Yeah, but I do think all of the fruits and vegetables that we consume today and all of the dairy products and meat products will still be with us. I mean, I don't see people not having turkey at Christmas in 100 years' time.
Yeah.
And I don't see Easter eggs vanishing. So things are going to stay much the same. I can't see dramatic changes. I can see alterations of levels of this and levels of that. But I don't see a new food coming along and replacing everything,
Yeah. And I suppose, just interesting, because obviously you have the expertise in the area with years and years. What would you say to someone like a beef farmer now? Say I'm not a beef farmer, but if I was, what advice would you have for someone who would listen to this and be like, God, panic stations when they hear reduction in meat and diets?
Well, I'm not a beef farmer myself, and yeah. I suppose, although I studied agricultural science many, many years ago, my knowledge of beef farming would be very limited. But there are definitely some farmers around that have adopted a very positive attitude to this. You see, I don't know enough about beef farming to advise the beef farmer as to what to do, but I do believe that there are farmers around that have developed systems which reduce the, if you like, greenhouse gas emissions from beef farming. And I think that maybe will be spread amongst beef farmers. Ultimately, the consumer will determine whether or not they want beef. And if the consumers don't want it to fall down. But at the moment, places like China and growing economies in Asia have a high requirement, high consumer demand for beef. So I wouldn't be panicking about it, but I think there will be a reduction in consumer demand in the long term.
And do you do any work, I suppose, on the messaging of getting, you know, nutritional information across to consumers, or would it just be all on the pure, I suppose, science-based side of things, Professor?
I would tend to stick to the science if I could, because the messages are really, I mean, I would be helping people formulate the messages, but that's not my job, so to speak. I would start just giving them the science and let them formulate what the message would be. But I would, if I thought the wrong message was going out, I wouldn't be afraid to speak my mind.
Perfect. No, because I was just even thinking there, you know, do you think from your experience with consumers, I suppose I was even thinking just like beef farms in New Zealand being carbon neutral, do you think messages like that would change what consumers would think around meat protein?
Oh yeah, I think if meat could be labelled as carbon neutral, coming from a carbon neutral farm, I absolutely guarantee people would go for that.
Yeah.
Over meat that's just ordinary generic meat. People who have a higher disposable income will always look for a niche product to make them feel good or taste good or be happy or whatever. So if there's a meat out there which is carbon neutral, it'll sell.
And it's a very interesting, I suppose, it's interesting to, I suppose, have that swing of looking all the way back to what we did, what, you know, in terms of your book, even that, looking back to what with the way we did consume food and then looking into projecting to the future. So, I don't know, someone has to take up the mantle of writing the next book in another few years. Another 100 years. I won't be around anyway, Professor, I know that.
I won't be either.
Yeah. Well, Professor, thank you very much for coming on and discussing all this with us on the podcast today. And the book, where's your book available?
The book is available in all good bookshops. It will be available from Lippi Press, the Lippi Press. And it's available as of, I think, next Monday from Amazon.
The Irish Country Living Podcast.